Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. It's Saturday night at Abhayagiri Monastery. Ordinarily, the monk giving the Dhamma talk would bow to Longpo Pasano. It's actually in our vinaya, our training rules, that the only people who can speak Dhamma, the only monks who can speak Dhamma in an assembly, are the senior monk or someone the senior monk grants permission to. So that's the first thing that would happen if Longpo Pasano were here. But he's not here. And ordinarily, in the Ajahn Chah tradition, monks under 10 wasa, 10 years as a monk, don't give Dhamma talks. But for a variety of circumstances, none of the Ajahns are here. And Lumpur told me this is a bit unique in the history of Abhayagiri. Ordinarily, he tries hard to keep Ajahns here. But we've had 3 days of it being just us. Abhayagiri, the next generation. So, we've been doing pretty well. We have very good examples to follow. So I've been really appreciative of Tanti Dipanyo and Tanpa Muto, who are sort of the junior-senior monks. And I'm also getting a bit more understanding of Lungpur's life and the life of the senior monks. I think I've been answering Dhamma questions for a total of 2.5 hours today, which is definitely, I think, more than... I don't think I've ever done that before. And I think Lungpur does that fairly routinely. And it's, yeah... I enjoy answering those question and answer sessions. It's also takes a bit of energy. So instead of trying to come up with a new topic for a Dhamma talk, I thought I would just answer one of the questions that was asked earlier. Actually, Ken asked a very good question after most of the tour bus group had left. And that is, okay, so when a lay person comes here to Abhayagiri Monastery, what is it that they can take away with them back to the other part of the world? And I said, well, there's lots of things that you can take away from here. It really depends on your capacities. What is it that you can take away? So one thing that you can learn here is the power of generosity. The monks here, we don't handle money. We don't eat any food that hasn't been handed into our hands or the hands of another monk. That's very deliberate. We're completely dependent on generosity. And Abhayagiri has done very well with this. I think I eat better food and I live in a more beautiful place than I think I ever would have as a layperson. And that's just how it is. But then for the lay people, to see that giving, giving brings joy. You watch the Thai people who come here, that the tour bus. That was a man who decided that for his birthday, he'd like to take a group of his friends and family to the monastery. And so they rented a wine country tour bus, and instead of going to the vineyards, they came up here. And brought a bunch of food and had a, seemed to have a really good time. They asked very good questions. And just this idea that for your birthday, the ordinary American thought is, for my birthday, I'll get a lot of stuff and that'll make me happy. But for this man's birthday, he did a really good thing by bringing his friends up to a monastery to be around monks and offer food and listen to Dhamma teachings. And many of his, maybe some of his friends would never come here on their own. And perhaps they learned something really valuable. Yeah, that's actually Dhamma Dana is considered a very, considered the highest form. So this man took his friends to go see and listen to the Dhamma. And I think he was really happy. And that's something you can take away. The power of generosity, the thought that human beings we're not intrinsically selfish. We're actually happiest when we give. And this is exemplified, I think, by Lumpur Pasano. Yesterday, I think I was talking about Lumpur Pasano, drinking tea up here, and I just happened to look at the tag on my tea bag, and it said, "Live to share." And that describes Lumpur Pasano. He really lives to share. That's what he's done his whole life. He's been abbot of monasteries for, I think, 33 years more or less continuously. And I've done all the easy parts these 3 days. He's done the hard stuff for a long time. But he doesn't get tired of it because I think he does live to share. Another thing that you can take away from this monastery is seeing the results of what happens from ethical behavior, keeping precepts. If you just watch the animals here, they're barely afraid of humans. The deer have become increasingly tame over the last 17 years. Now the foxes, certainly, most of the time they ignore us, sometimes they're curious. I think even the squirrels are a bit calmer than usual squirrels. And that's because they've learned that in this 200 acres, no one hurts them. A couple days ago, I noticed that someone had left their iPod charging, or something, charging in the laundry room. And this is a community with people coming in and out all the time, but I didn't know whose it was. But just to recognize it, right, you can, they were just assuming, right, nobody's going to take this. And that's not a bad assumption here. We keep the doors, keep almost all the doors unlocked. And I don't know that we've barely had anybody try to steal things, and the one attempt was actually more comical than harmful. And you can trust the speech here. People really don't lie, and we have many fewer accidents, I think, because there's no intoxicating drugs here. And this, keeping these precepts sometimes seems counterintuitive, you know, from a more worldly perspective. Precepts are sort of, well, they cramp my style. That's the way it's looked at. But instead, when you realize the effect, the Buddha described keeping precepts as giving freedom from fear to innumerable beings. And yeah, if I don't kill or steal or lie, then no one around me has to worry that I'm going to harm them. And that's a perspective that's, yeah, certainly not always present in the world, and it's something very valuable you can take away. And the final aspect of keeping precepts is just self-respect. If you keep these, you can look in the mirror and say, wow, yeah, there is something worthy of respect here. They really are the behavior of a noble person. Going on from there, another thing, if one has the interest and capacity to absorb it, a Bhayagiri monastery is a place you can learn how to train your mind. There are many forms of meditation taught here. Lompur Pasano is a real expert at it. He's had lots of experience. And it can be difficult, it can be frustrating. The Buddha likened the mind to a monkey swinging from tree to tree and grabbing fruit and screeching and making a total mess of things. And that's not a bad description. Or the other colorful description is the mind being dragged around as if it were a post, and six animals representing the sense bases were all trying to pull it towards the particular thing they wanted. So imagine a monkey, bird, crocodile, jackal, dog, and I don't know, I've forgotten the other one, try a peacock, all pulling on a post in different directions, and whichever one of them is strongest, that's where that'll drag the other five animals with it, but it's going to be a catastrophe. And training the mind in mindfulness of the body is like pounding that post into the ground and then waiting for the animals to realize they can't go anywhere and just lie down and sleep. It takes time and patience, and for a while it looks like the animals aren't any calmer than when the post was just getting dragged around in the air. But over time, especially if you can come here or go on retreat elsewhere and give it some real effort, you know, you learn that, yeah, the calm mind is a very happy, bright mind. And, yeah, one can discover that actually the happiness due to a stable, settled mind, yeah, outshines the happiness of any sensual pleasure. That's something that the Buddha taught that, and you can recognize it. Because sensual pleasures, you realize, you know, like eating good food tends to, there's pleasure to it, but you watch what it does to the mind, and the mind becomes more and more diffuse. And eventually that wonderful, say, ravioli, you know, it was great. The first ravioli was great, but after 10th ravioli, you barely notice. But with the mind, even though the pleasure of breathing is quite subtle, can do is when, if you make the mind more and more subtle, because the mind becomes more subtle, more refined, you actually can enjoy that breath. And it becomes very, it can become very enjoyable, just being with the breath. And it's because the mind is so refined. And this is when you really begin to get an inkling that there's really something beyond the sensual world. That there could be and is a well-being that isn't dependent on getting what you want, on things being pleasant. Because you can see, right, yeah, happiness, well-being is produced by the mind. If the mind is in good shape, if the mind isn't proliferating, if it's calm, if it's peaceful, if it's bright, then, yeah, the external world is not such a problem. Well, that's something you can take away. And then, the most powerful benefit was what the Buddha himself sought in all this. When he went forth from his life as a prince, he apparently had access to almost all sensual pleasures that were available at the time, and had a very good life, but he saw the drawbacks of that. And in particular, he made the resolution that I'm not going to stop looking. I won't be content with, say, realizing, you know, wonderful states of meditation and then teaching that to other people and being an honored spiritual leader of my country and community. He was offered that twice and turned it down because he could see, no, this concentration is wonderful, but it doesn't put a complete end to distress. And so he investigated more, and we have the option of looking into the mind. And we have Lungpo Sumedho was here about 3 weeks ago, and so from time to time we have very accomplished teachers come through to explain what they did and how they did it. And Lungpo Sumedho talks about finding that space between the thoughts, between the perceptions, and recognizing that just like physical space contains objects but is completely unperturbed by them, so too there's that knowing nature of the mind that contains thoughts, perceptions, mental formations. It contains the entire perception of the body itself. It contains them, but it's also completely untouched by them, just like space. It doesn't get perturbed whatever object you put in it. It's more important to focus on the qualities of this than it is to try to find the right name. So I particularly like the description of the Dhamma. It comes from our morning and evening chanting, but it's as old as the Buddha's dispensation itself, that list. We chanted it in Pali tonight. It began with Swakato Bhagavata Dhammo. The Dhamma is well expounded by the Blessed One, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inwards, to be experienced individually by the wise. And that's just one translation of the Pali. There's other translations which are equally useful, and it's not about getting the right translation for the Pali words. It's about using that to point at and winnow out our experience, because there's no other place the dead list could be than right here, right now, but we're not seeing it. So using those adjectives, using that description, what is it in the experience? What is it in the experience that's timeless? What is it in the experience that leads inwards rather than outwards? Or alternatively, leading onwards is another translation of that one. To be experienced individually by the wise. And to do that, one needs the support of all three of the previous steps that I've described. Yeah. In order to see it, you have to have really purified your conduct and let the mind settle, because the mind that's busy, the mind that's distracted, can't see what's right here. So that's the final step, what we all have the potential to recognize in this practice. And one other question that someone asked later on this tea time was, why did I choose to leave the world of physics and come here to a monastery? I was a physics graduate student at Berkeley. And in hindsight, I told a story, and I don't think the story necessarily answered the question. It told how, but it didn't entirely answer why. I mean, you can always come, there's many ways to tell a story. And of course, what really matters is not trying to figure out the real reason why, but you know, when I explain what is it that can be of benefit to others, how is it? And I think one of the things that I recognized, just was investigating, trying to figure out how to do something relevant for, I remember part of my quest was I wanted to find a career that would respond to the state of the world. And what I was doing in physics, I'd been trying to angle towards more applied physics because I thought that would be more relevant, but it turned out that most of the physicists really love to do physics because they love to do physics, and I found that they would kind of invent the relevance of their work because they like to do it. And there's nothing intrinsically wrong with that. I mean, that, you know, it's not. But if one comes at it from, instead of a perspective of, I love to do physics, how can I make this seem relevant, you know, to, I really want to do something that's relevant. You know, what is it that I can do? Then you look at a bigger picture. And I could imagine, I never actually plotted this graph, but I know what it would look like. If you plot from, say, I did some research into subjective well-being, which is the technical term for happiness from psychologists. So what's interesting about subjective well-being is that people seem to report, you know, in the United States, seem to report fairly moderately high levels of well-being, but it's been pretty much flat since 1950. Not a lot has changed. However happy we are, we're not getting happier. We're also probably not getting terribly more depressed either. At least that was the research as of as of probably around 2000. But now plot, say, the per capita energy consumption on that same graph. And my guess is that between 1950 and 2000, it goes up by about a factor of 3. So one way of casting this is that since 1950, the United States has become 3 times less efficient at converting converting fossil fuel energy into happiness. And I didn't hear anybody else who was thinking or talking like that. It's not very... Ordinarily, we think about things like gross domestic product, where consumption is seen as a good. But that's, consumption why? There's two ways to work on this. You can definitely work at reducing resource consumption, and that was I thought about that, but realized that I was getting tired of doing science. Maybe I'd just been doing it for long enough without enough support. But I was really interested in Buddhism, because this practice has the ability to dramatically enhance well-being while at the same time keeping one's resource usage either constant or declining. I certainly consume much less resources than I would have if I had continued in the world. And boy, I think a great deal happier as well. So personally, at least, I've done pretty well at that happiness divided by resource usage quotient. And so, to give people an understanding of this, because, cutting back resource usage is a hard sell in the United States. It's just not what people want to do. So that's a tough one. Whereas exemplifying a way that, that increases happiness, that's something people might be more interested in. And, I don't feel much of a sense of having to change the world just to contribute at least something that's a move and, that's moving in the right direction. And if other people are interested, they can plug into what we're doing at Abhayagiri Monastery. So I will offer that for your reflection tonight. Kandamayam dhamma kataya sadhukam dhamma sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.